Okay, good morning. It is wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to see everybody, whether you're in person or online. And I think it's great to kind of turn that corner towards Christmas. Today is actually the Sunday before that I consider Christmas's season has begun. I've tried for the past several years in my household to delay the beginning of Christmas until after Thanksgiving. And even the framing, I hear some laughs now, even by framing it that way lets you know that those attempts have failed. Every year I ask that we do not celebrate Christmas until after my birthday, which is mid-November, and then immediately after my birthday, the Christmas tree goes up. And it's a celebration in our house. Our kids love it. Whitney loves it. I love Christmas too, but I want a little bit of time to process Thanksgiving. So I've lost the battle every year, and then this year, about mid-November, we started putting up our Christmas tree. When we put it in our front living room, and we decided to include our kids. We have a 5-year-old, and then sweet baby girl Isla is about 2. She turns 2 in December. But we kind of had to decide, how are we going to put up this Christmas tree with these 2 children and not lose a lot of precious ornaments? And so what we decided to do was to throw on a movie. Now, by the slide back there, you kind of guess what movie we decided to throw on. And we decided to introduce Isla, who is not yet 2, to Home Alone. Now, Judah has seen Home Alone numerous times, and I understand a lot of you are already connecting the dots. Kevin McAllister is basically Judah Kittinger. We get it. We know. It is what we deal with. We understand. We are his parents. I have let him watch this movie too many times, thus the Kevin McAllister attitude. But our kids watched it as we put up these ornaments, and they cackled, they laughed. Judah loves what he calls the pranks or the traps that Kevin sets on Marv and Harry. He gets into it. And so for the last several weeks, that has been the movie when the kids have asked to watch a movie, they want to watch Home Alone. And once you go beyond the traps, and what we're going to do if you're watching online or you're going to watch this later, Rob is actually going to drop a link in our comment section. So if you're watching on your phone, it's below you. If you're watching on a computer, it's to my left, of a link of all the traps that Kevin does on Marv and Harry in all the movies. Because we're not going to talk about the traps this morning, because I know that's what a lot of us want to watch. They're fun. We get it. But I see a lot of humanity in Home Alone that is often overlooked because of the traps. I think that Kevin wants to be seen. I think at its core, Kevin wants to be seen and respected by his family, by the adults in his life. And that's really what the whole movie is about. It's about seeing people as people with purpose, with meaning, with life. And so I thought the best way to discuss that this morning is to show 2 clips from Home Alone. So the first clip that I want to show kind of sets the tone for the second one. And we've got it sermon clip 1. Rob's got it ready for us. But the first clip kind of starts the movie off as to how Kevin finds himself in the predicament, but also kind of the notion of how Kevin doesn't want to see his family. So let's go ahead and play that first one, Rob.
There are 15 people in this house. You're the only one who has to make trouble.
I'm the only one getting dumped up.
You're the only one acting up. Now get upstairs.
I am upstairs, dummy. Third floor?
Go.
It's scary up there.
Don't be silly. Fuller will be up in a little while.
I don't want a super Fuller. You know about him. He wets the bed. He'll pee all over me. I know it.
Fine. We'll put him somewhere else.
I'm sorry.
It's too late. Get upstairs.
Everyone in this family hates me.
Then maybe you should ask Santa for a new family.
I don't want a new family. I don't want any family.
Just stay up there. I don't want to see you again for the rest of the night.
I don't want to see you again for the rest of my whole life. And I don't want to see anybody else either.
I hope you don't mean that. You'd feel pretty sad if you woke up tomorrow morning and you didn't have a family.
No, I wouldn't.
Then say it again. Maybe it'll happen.
I hope I never see any jerks again.
I wish they would all just disappear.
Now this clip ends with an electrical outage happening that kills the alarms in the house. They wake up late, and the movie really kind of picks up pace if you've seen it before. If you haven't, like, what are you doing? Like, leave here, go watch it. I'm fine with it. We'll talk later. But the movie really picks up pace here when kind of the family realizes that they're late to the airport, and they have to pick up pace, and they have to go, and all this stuff. And Kevin is left on the third floor. Now, when Kevin wakes up, he believes that his wish has come true, that his family is gone. And it kind of, for the next hour or so of this movie, Kevin is alone. He goes grocery shopping alone. He goes to the pharmacy alone. And he has to defend his house alone against the intrusions of Marv and Harry, which are great names for characters. But he has to do all of this stuff alone. And the movie ends with that humanity element that I was talking about, where the one thing that Kevin wants at the end of the movie is to be seen. And we've got that clip too, so let's watch that one and then we'll move on.
Merry Christmas, sweetheart. Oh, Kevin, I'm so sorry.
Okay, so I've only got to see this a few times because our kids make us rewind and watch the pranks, and that's kind of all we get to watch the movie, but it's actually as sweet as I remember. I love that clip for a lot of different reasons, but I think it brings us back to this conversation of humanity, about the importance of being seen, because when we're seen, we realize that we're valued and that we have purpose and that we have meaning, and you see this in this movie, this amazing Christmas movie, that Kevin recognizes that. In this moment, the only thing that he wants in his life is to be seen. Jesus talks about seeing people all throughout Scripture, all throughout his ministry. And there's a story this morning that I want to look at in John chapter 4 in which Jesus sees someone that society has rejected. Society has chosen not to see, or at least not to see with value or meaning or purpose. And so we'll start in John chapter 4 with... Now, Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was going and gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. This is something that like a disciple might have included. But so he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. So we've got a map here because I want to show you where Jesus is going. So that bottom part is going to say Judea, and in between, above Judea is Samaria, and then above Samaria is Galilee. And kind of for all purposes, Jesus will walk basically directly north from Judea into Galilee. Now, at the time, most pious Jews would not have even stepped foot in Samaria. They would have actually gone around into that region called Perea, into the Decapolis, and they would have gone into Galilee that way, completely avoiding Samaria altogether. And this is because of a deep-rooted disdain, hatred, whatever you want to call it, towards the Samaritans. That actually goes back into about 586 BC when the Jews were taken into Babylonian captivity. The Babylonians took everyone in this region except the Samaritans. And so there's this weird notion of like the Samaritans weren't good enough to be taken into captivity that kind of developed over time, and that's kind of where this disdain develops. And so I mention that because there's going to be a historical connection that Jesus is going to have with the Samaritan woman that is kind of overlooked when we don't understand that they're actually from the same region. They have the same kind of theological background almost too. Now, the Samaritans are going to have a little bit of mysticism, a little bit of kind of superstitious beliefs as well merged into their religious beliefs. But at the same time, like, they're going to both understand who Jacob is in a little bit. So let's go to the next slide, Rob. The next one says, now he had to go through Samaria. Now, I mentioned a second ago that most pious Jews would not have gone through Samaria. And so John includes this to say, like, Jesus had to go through Samaria. Jesus had to see people in Samaria. Jesus really technically didn't have to go. He's choosing to go through Samaria because he knows there are people there of value. There are people there with meaning, with purpose that he needs to see. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. If you go back to that one slide, Rob, the map real quick. And the map about midway in Samaria, and it's too small, and I apologize for that, but about halfway into Samaria is going to be Sychar. Now, the only biblical reference that we have of this region is from Genesis chapter 33. And I think we've got that slide too. But in Genesis 33, after Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. He's going to buy a plot of land. He's going to build an altar there, and he's going to call it El-Hohi Israel. And that is where this point of reference is coming from. It's from Genesis chapter 33. So back to the John chapter 4, let's do 4 through 6, that slide, perfect. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. Now, I connect a lot with being tired. I have two small children. I wake up tired. And so when I hear that Jesus was tired from a journey, I'm like, yes, like, my man, I get you. We're connecting on this level. And so Jesus is exhausted from this journey, and he finds himself at this well, and it was about noon. Now, depending on what your Bible say, it may say the sixth hour. If you're looking at a Roman kind of clock, the sixth hour is going to be 6 p.m. The Jewish clock is going to give us about noon, which is where this reference is coming from. There's some debate whether or not this is happening in the evening or at essentially high noon. I believe this is happening at noon for two different reasons. No one is at the well except this woman that's going to enter in just a moment. And the reason that no one else is at this well is because it is hot. No one wants to carry a jar of water in the hottest part of the day. And the only reason you would do that is to avoid people. It's because you don't want to be seen. And so this story is picking up here at noon. No one else is around, but Jesus at this well. So the next slide reads, when a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." And we talked a little bit about why this kind of deep-rooted hatred towards these two communities exists. And I've often wondered, like, how does she know that Jesus is a Jew? It's likely because of his dialect, maybe his mannerisms, or maybe the fact that he is a stranger talking to her at the well. She would have easily assumed, like, you're not from here if you're talking to me at this well asking me for water, because this is something that we don't do here. But Jesus is already breaking those societal norms just in this moment. And so it continues. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Now the Samaritans and people in this ancient community believed that living water was spring water. That's what they called it. They called spring water living water because it bubbled up. It looked like it was alive. And so Jesus is actually doing like a play on words here of like, you think that you're getting living water, but I have a water that is truly living, a water that you really are searching for. So the conversation progresses here. "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob?" You see that Genesis reference there from Genesis 33. She's referencing a common historical figure in both of their minds. "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock?" So Jesus kind of tells her a little bit more about this living water that gives eternal life. And the conversation changes to probably like what we all know in this story from John chapter 4. In verse 15, the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." I think this is honest. I think this is sincere. I don't think she is being sarcastic. I don't think she's being malicious. I don't think she's even being rude. I think she's saying, if this water is real that you're talking about, like, I want this water. How do I get it? Where is it? Where is this living, this true living water that gives eternal life? Where is it? And then Jesus says this, "Go call your husband and come back." Now, I want to pause here because this is often the focal point of John chapter 4. And it's often understood as Jesus is calling this woman out because of the sin of her life, because she's living with a man that's not her husband, that she's had five husbands in the past. And we often kind of sit there and we camp there and we say, look, this story is about Jesus calling somebody out on their sin. I don't think so. Because I don't know if you've ever tried to reach somebody by calling them out on their sin. It doesn't work. Like, if the first thing you do is you're like, "Hey, it's really nice to meet you. Let me tell you what you're doing wrong with your life." I don't think that that is what Jesus is doing, because I am a human. I don't think that that is how humans respond to stuff like this. I think the reason why Jesus says what he says next, and I don't even have it on the screen because I don't want to like lean into it that hard, but I think the reason why Jesus says, like, "You're right to say that you don't have a husband because you've had five husbands and the man that you're living with right now is not your husband," I think the reason that he even draws attention to that is so that she knows, "I know everything about you. Like, I can see you, and I still see you as somebody with value. I still see you as somebody with meaning and with purpose." He doesn't do it to call out the sin. He does it to show her that he sees her. And think about this woman's existence for a little bit. She's carrying a jar of water at a well the hottest part of the day, probably every single day, because she doesn't want to be seen. She doesn't want to have to listen to the murmurs of her community members. She doesn't want to have to hear people say, "Oh, there she goes." She goes to the well alone so she doesn't have to be seen, but Jesus is saying, "Hey, you've come here today. I've traveled through Samaria because I want you to know that you are seen, that you are loved." And so this call, this reference to her husband's isn't about sin. It's about showing her, like, "I am the prophet that you seek. I am the Messiah." I think he's looking past that. That stuff that we get hung up on, I think he's looking way beyond that to say, "Look, you have meaning, you have purpose, you have value. I'm sorry that your neighbors, your friends, all these people around you, they don't see that, but I see that in you." Because the conversation moves into this. The woman said, "I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, I am he." Think about this moment for just a second. This is just like, I assume it was a Tuesday. I don't know, probably. But I assume it was just a random day of the week where this lady's whole existence has changed. She went to the well as somebody that didn't want to be seen, and she's about to leave the well changed because she realizes that she has purpose, she has meaning, she has value. Like, the impact that we can have on people when we see them is astronomical. And we often just overlook it because we get so busy and consumed with our lives that we fail to see that we have to see people as individuals made and created by God and made and created with the purpose. Now, if you've listened to my sermons before and I get a chance to talk about disciples, I love making fun of them because I would be a disciple. I know that. I would be one of the people that just like bumbling around, trying to figure things out, trying to do my best, but just like messing everything up along the way. And the next passage is the disciples show up at this well and they've got all this food. And I love that too. I love that they are like, they have gone into town to go get Jesus food. And they come back and I just assume they have bags of groceries and like, "All right, Jesus, what do you want to make? Like, we got it. We got your favorite dishes." And it's just Jesus and this Samaritan woman are just standing there at the well. And there is just something that is powerful about this moment that they walk up on and make awkward. Because the text just says that they just stand there. And they're like, what is happening? Like, the text says that nobody said, why is he talking to this woman? Nobody asked a weird question. But, like, you know it's weird. Like, you know that if you're having a conversation and 12 dudes with food roll up on you, like, that is a weird scene that's happening. And that's exactly what happens to the Samaritan woman and Jesus. Is they're just standing there having this moment, this life-changing, life-altering moment of this woman's existence. And the disciples roll up and they're like, who wants a falafel? Like, I mean, it's just like, it's just a weird thing. And the text tells us, then, in verse 28, then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to town and said to the people, come see a man who told me everything I did. Could this be the Messiah? They came out of the town and made their way toward him. Now think about that for just a moment. Because this action of the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 sounds very similar to the action the first disciples do in Luke chapter 5. In Luke chapter 5, when Jesus calls his disciples, they drop their nets. They leave everything they have come to know, and they go and they follow Jesus. And in a similar way, in John chapter 4, what this woman does is she leaves the thing, the weight that she has brought with her to the well, and says, hey, I'm not about this anymore, because I have been seen. For the first time in a long time, she has realized that she has purpose, that she has value, that she has meaning. And think about this too. The very people that she attempted to avoid every single day of her life, those are the first people that she goes and tells, I have encountered the Messiah. I have met somebody that can change your life like they've changed mine. So she went back to the town and said to the people, and this is when I look at this text, the thing that I get the most excited about is what happens next. Because in John chapter 4, verse 39 through 42, the text reads, many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them. And he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, get this, many more became believers. Think about that for a second. The woman that this community had rejected, had shunned to the point that every day at noon, she would carry her water jar to the well in the heat and the sunlight just to avoid these people, has now brought all of these people to Christ. And it all began when Jesus saw her, when Jesus chose to go through Samaria, was he knew that there were people there that needed to be seen, that people needed to be reminded that they have value, they have meaning, they have purpose. It is just, it gets me every time that she is willing to do this for the people that have rejected her. And the reason she has the confidence to do this is because Jesus sees her. Friends, we must not forget how important it is to see other people with value. Because when we see other people with value, we can change their lives, and then we don't know what their lives change may do to other people. There's this overflowing effect that happens when we treat people the way that Jesus treats them. And more so when we see people the way that Jesus sees them. Verse 42, they said to the woman, we no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world. A powerful story. Just because Jesus chose to go somewhere that people of his community wouldn't have gone through. But Jesus sees people in Samaria as people of value. People with meaning and with purpose. And he goes there so he can see them. Now, I began this sermon referencing Kevin McAllister, and I want to end this sermon referencing another Kevin McAllister-like person, my son Judah. I've already mentioned, like, we know, he's trying to pull traps all the time in our house, like, we get it. We live, you know, kind of in just chaos because of Judah, but we love him. And when school started, we held him out. We did the virtual experience for a little bit, probably selfishness. Obviously, like, I love Judah. I don't think he's, like, my best friend, but he's up there. Like, I love hanging out with this kid. And doing the virtual experience gave us more time with Judah. And so, like, we were, like, and it was probably trying to delay, like, him growing up. And, like, I know this. Like, I get it. But when when they came to where you could open the reopening or whatever it's called, readmission or whatever, we sent him. we were like, okay, like he needs to go to big kid school, like he needs to be around other kids, and so we sent him. And the whole week building up to this, October 19th, the whole week building up to this, like I'm psychologically preparing myself for this. Like sending my boy to school. Like I'm not ready for it, but I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm like, okay, we're doing this. Like we did like a drive-by, like, okay, look, we're gonna drop you off here. Your teacher's gonna come up to the door. She's gonna get you out. And like the night before I had even coached myself, like when he's gripping on to me, I was like, Dad, I don't wanna leave you. Like when that's happening, like I need to be strong and I need to just push him into school because that's what he needs to do. And he didn't do that, which kind of hurt, but he just got out of the car and was like, see you guys later, you know. It was, you know, it hurt, you know. I was like, oh, man, this doesn't feel great. And we pull out, the whole family went to drop him off his first day of school. And when we pull out, I'm weeping. I mean, ugly crying, not like cute dad crying. Like, I'm weeping. And Whitney's like, what is going on? I'm like, I don't know. Like, he's going to school. I'm not. And even Isla was like, hey, this is weird. But, he just bounces up to, you know, the front door and his little book bag, and he's just acting like he's a big kid, and it got me. And so for the first few weeks, like, I was super worried about him. And getting anything about his school experience is like pulling teeth. I mean, he's probably lying to us, like, you know, I did great today. You know, we don't know. We're trying to ask him, like, how was school, what happened, and he's like, oh, I was fine. You know, he's like, I'm like, are you already a teenager? Like, yeah, quit hanging out with teens. But you got to give me something, Judah. But he started telling stories about a man with a tie. And he would talk about how the man with the tie is a great reader. And he'd even be like, he's a better reader than you, Dad. And I'm like, hey, chill. You know, like, I don't know who this guy is. But he's telling stories about the man with the tie is so funny, and the man with the tie gave me goldfish. And he's telling all these kind of stories, and he keeps coming back to, like, the man with the tie. And there's a point where we're like, okay, this is clearly, like, a disciplinary adult. Like, they're like, hey, this kid's bad. He's going to have to sit with you for a little bit. And Judah has just befriended, you know, this adult. And he would just keep telling these really kind of sweet stories about how nice the man with the tie was. And then a few weeks later at church, you guys know this, Phil Davis works at Williams Magnet, where Judah goes. And I just said, Phil, this is super weird, but do you wear a tie to work? And Phil goes, I wear a tie every single day. And then it hit me that the man with the tie was Phil Davis. And I just want y'all to know, and I told Phil I was going to say this, like, the fact that somebody saw my kid at school and, like, made an impact on him meant the world to me. That Judah wasn't getting as much trouble as we thought was great. But for somebody to add value to somebody because they're willing to see them means a lot. And it changes our experience. It reminds us that we have value, that we have purpose, that we have meaning. And I saw that in that moment. And I thought about how, like, Judah would come home and he would talk about how great Phil was. And I finally was like, all right, we got to call him Mr. Davis now that we know who it is. We know it's not the man with the tie. We know that it's Mr. Davis. And just the impact that that made on Judah, but then also the impact that that made on Whitney and myself, knowing that somebody at school is seeing us, that's seeing our kid, and they care about our kid, and they're instilling value, meaning, and purpose. And friends, that is what we are called to do this week. We are called to see our neighbors. We are called to see people in our community. We are called to see them as people with meaning, with purpose, with value, because that's exactly what Jesus did in John chapter 4. And because Jesus was willing to see that woman, it changed her life and it changed the life of the people around her too. We're going to have a song and then we'll have a prayer.